I would like to introduce our speaker today, and we're very pleased to have Professor Lisa Ramsey from the University of San Diego School of Law. And Lisa is an academic, and she teaches and writes on IP generally, but her speciality, quite rightly, is trademarks. A very good choice. And so her focus is on trademark law and free speech rights and the effect of trademark protection of inherently so valuable words, symbols, and product features, and whether the trademark rights will have an effect on the competition, free competition, and freedom of expression. So this is where Lisa has her attention at the moment. In 2024, she testified before the US Judiciary Committee's IP Subcommission or Committee on First Amendment Implications of Anti-Impersonation Law, in particular, unauthorized digital replicas, which became known as the No Fakes Act. She's also an active member of the American IP Law Association and works in the Intermodel Trademark Guidelines. In her previous life, before she became an academic, Lisa was a IP litigator. Last year, she was recognized as a woman of influence in the law by the San Diego Business Journal. And today, we're really lucky to have Lisa here talking to us about her new book, which is Trademarks and Free Speech, Conflicts and Resolutions. And I should just say that if you want to get the book and you go to the link to Lisa's talk, you'll see that CUP is offering a discount to people who order it. Anyway, we're very pleased to have you, and thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the kind introduction. Thanks to all of you for coming to my presentation today. So the title of my new book is called Trademarks and Free Speech, Conflicts and Resolutions. And I've been writing about this topic for about 20 years. So this book is kind of a culmination of everything that I've been thinking about during that time frame. So the right to freedom of expression, you've probably heard of this, right? It's protected in treaties, in constitutions, and in statutes in the United Kingdom, the United States, and other parts of the world. Trademark laws regulate the use of words, names, symbols, product features, and so therefore, trademark laws can implicate the right to freedom of expression and potentially violate it. But most trademark laws are consistent with the right to freedom of expression. In this book, though, I explore when trademark laws might be problematic for freedom of expression purposes, but also for fair competition. So here is information about my book from my website. In addition to being able to purchase it online, I was very excited. I went by the Cambridge University bookstore after I got into Cambridge. This is my first time to Cambridge. You have a lovely city here. And it is for sale there if you want to check it out. But I want to thank Jennifer Davis. She was very kind to provide me comments on the book as I was writing it and to provide an endorsement. I also have a lot of amazing people who I think are here online listening who gave me comments. So thanks to everyone who provided feedback and to everyone who's written in this area before me. Martin Sinflabin, Rebecca Tushnet, Christoph Geiger have done great work in this field. My book is responding in part to claims of certain people, companies, that they should be able to register certain words or phrases like hate speech, swear words, other offensive expression, that they have some sort of free speech right to register these things. In the book, I turn this around and say that it's actually problematic from a free expression perspective if we register these things because they inherently communicate ideas. They do not function well as source identifying trademarks also. So in the book, I focus on trademark registration law and trademark enforcement law. My main expertise is US law, but I do teach an international intellectual property law course. And the book does talk about European law in Europe, European Union. I have a couple examples from the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and Singapore. But if you want, the book is targeted, to be honest, at attorneys, students, faculty members that want to learn a little bit about these different areas of the law and how the right to freedom of expression potentially impact whether these laws are actually valid in various countries. So I'm going to start off with a couple examples of where from the news that I just recently talked about in my classes, just kind of let you kind of understand what we're talking about here, right? So you may have heard of Taylor Swift, right? And maybe you have not heard, though, of this woman here. She was a showgirl in Las Vegas, in Nevada. And after many years in the industry, she decided to go on a routine where she would talk about being a showgirl. And she called her kind of entertainment, you know, she would do a show, Confessions of a Showgirl. And she actually registered this phrase as a trademark. I would argue this is a pretty weak trademark, right? It's a descriptive term for her goods and services, right? So recently, Taylor Swift came out with a new album, A Life of a Showgirl. When she came out with this album, her attorneys, who are often trying to protect their IP rights, tried to register Life of a Showgirl as a mark for entertainment services and other kinds of goods and services. The trademark office actually said that this mark might actually cause confusion with the mark of the Las Vegas showgirl. Then we have a lawsuit filed by the Las Vegas showgirl woman, who I forget her name, but she files a lawsuit against Taylor Swift's companies and claims that that she's entitled to an injunction to stop the sales of her albums, which I just think is very problematic, right? These are weak trademarks, et cetera. But one interesting thing in the United States is that if you actually try to claim trademark rights in a phrase, now you can't take advantage of certain speech protective defenses in the United States. There's a test called the Rogers test, which would apply if you're using a mark in the title or content of a song or a film. But in a new case that just recently came out, Jack Daniels versus VIP Products, the Supreme Court said that if you are claiming trademark rights in the phrase or the design, you can't invoke these speech protective tests like the Rogers balancing test or any other threshold speech protective test. So that might also apply to perhaps a requirement that a use be commercial for liability. In the United States, infringement actions don't require the use to be commercial. It's not necessarily the case in other countries. In Europe, for example, it has to be in the use in the course of trade. But in the United States, our infringement laws can apply to non-commercial speech. And what the court here is saying is if you yourself are claiming trademark rights in this context, you can't take advantage of certain kinds of threshold First Amendment defenses. I think that's a problem. It's one thing I complain about in the book. Here's another example. You may have heard of the magazine Vogue, right? It's about fashion. Again, not the most strongest trademark for those of you. I think it's a French word. It means fashion. But there's a woman in Los Angeles who decided to start posting photographs of dogs under the name Dogue. And she actually applied to register this as a trademark as well. Mostly she was posting online, but she also did sell, I guess, some print copies at some shops in Los Angeles. Condé Nast, the owner of the Vogue mark, has filed a lawsuit against her. And again, she's tried to register this phrase as a trademark, so she's going to be limited in her defenses. She's claiming this is a parody. So it's kind of different than the Taylor Swift example, where the term is being used for Taylor Swift, right? Life of a Showgirl, that's a descriptive informational use. This one here is kind of poking fun at Vogue, also talking about dogs, so a little bit of a different use. In the book, I talk about the different kinds of defenses you can raise if someone challenges your use of a particular trademark. My kind of main approach is to think about there are three different ways that marks can be used: an informational use, an expressive use, or a decorative use. I kind of explore the current doctrines that might allow these uses, but also their limitations. And we'll talk about that later. All right, here's another example for you. You've probably heard of McDonald's, which you may not know is that they used to have a registration for extra value meal for their restaurant services. Now, this is, again, a pretty weak trademark. Apparently, they haven't used it recently, and it was canceled off the trademark register in the United States. This attorney, Josh Gerben, I recommend, he has a great blog post about various kinds of litigation in the United States. He in this blog post says, oh, well, this is an example of, you know, companies need to continue to use their trademarks. They might lose their rights. You know, here, of course, everybody knows about McDonald's. This is a strong mark with secondary meaning. My take on this is McDonald's should never have owned trademark rights in the phrase extra value meal for restaurant services. This is speech harmful. It's anti-competitive. Any company should be able to use this phrase in the context of providing food to consumers. All right, here's another example. You may have heard of Snoop Dogg, right? He applied to register smoke weed every day for a store that sells cannabis and related products. His application was refused registration because under federal law in the United States, selling cannabis is illegal. In California, some other states, it is legal. But this was one reason why this application was refused. Another is that this phrase does not serve as a source identifying trademark for his goods and services. It's actually a lyric to a song. A different artist, musical artist, actually has used this phrase. It's also pretty common on shirts and other products out there that the examiner kind of cited up here on the right-hand side of your screen. And so this doctrine, failure to function doctrine, has been used increasingly by the USPTO, US Patent and Trademark Office, to refuse registration of hate speech and swear words after the Supreme Court struck down laws on the ground they were inconsistent with the First Amendment because they discriminated based on viewpoint. I think this doctrine, trademark failure to function, is a great law. It helps promote freedom of expression by preventing certain words and phrases and decorative features of products from being registered as trademarks. It also promotes competition by leaving language in the public domain for everyone to use. So we'll see what happens with these cases. Again, these are very current events. My guess is that Snoop Dogg's going to try to continue to get rights in that phrase. All right, next we have Occupy Mars. A couple years ago, a woman tried to register this phrase for t-shirts, right? She wanted to sell t-shirts that have this on the front. Someone named Ken Real, who operates a Facebook group page on Facebook, mostly made up of people who sell merchandise to like Amazon, eBay, those kinds of platforms. He filed what's called a letter of protest. It's where you educate the trademark office about a problem with a certain trademark application. And he let the office know that, look, this phrase Occupy Mars is something that people want to put on the front of t-shirts. It's not serving as a source identifying trademark. And so back in 2017, the trademark office did actually refuse to register it. And this guy now has on this Facebook page, he actually has got a bunch of small businesses together and they monitor the trademark registry. Anytime someone tries to register a common phrase for t-shirts, right, class 25, they file a letter of protest and they try to they say, look, by mama boy or dad girl or something like that. They say, no, these things should not be registered. People in this industry want to be able to sell shirts with this phrase. And he approached me after I gave a presentation at this USPTO event. And so I've joined it. So I've been kind of lurking and seeing all these people post about these just shocking phrases that have either been registered or people are trying to register. So most recently, someone new tried to register Occupy Mars. And then told Ken Real he couldn't actually sell shirts that had this phrase on the front. And in Amazon's brand registry, if you have a registration or you've applied to register a certain mark, you can actually use the brand registry to take down products, which is very problematic. Obviously, if these are counterfeiters, we want the products to come down. But in a situation like this, it's very problematic. This application is still pending. Why should we care? Well, maybe you want to buy a shirt that says Occupy Mars and you want it to be there available for a low price, right? Or maybe a different color. If there's only one company that owns trademark rights to this phrase in connection with t-shirts, they might have limited colors. They might charge a lot of money. Here we have Elon Musk is wearing an Occupy Mars shirt. According to this story, right, he's actually now thinking he's going to go to the moon. Who knows? Some people say this is actually an image of the moon rather than of Mars. I don't know. But if you go to the SpaceX website, you can buy the t-shirt. If someone gets exclusive rights to Occupy Mars for t-shirts, that means that they can take down these kinds of products. And you might say, well, wait a second. When it's on the front of a shirt, that's not a trademark use. I would agree with you. When you apply to register a trademark, if you submit what's called a specimen of use, evidence of your use, if it's just on the front, that might be refused registration on the ground it's ornamental or decorative. But the problem is that people put these phrases on the labels or hang tags and then say, look, I'm using it as a trademark. But this doesn't always work. Someone tried to register Black Lives Matter a couple of years ago and put that on the labels and the hang tags, but also on the front of the shirt. And the trademark office said, no, this fails to function as a trademark. So we'll see what happens with this case. But again, another example of people trying to obtain exclusive trademark rights to phrases that should arguably remain in the public domain. So let's back up a couple years ago, 2017, Simon Tam, who was in a band that had all Asian American members, they were going by the Slants, trying to reclaim this term that had been used in a derogatory manner towards people of Asian descent. So this is different than the Washington Redskins football team. We had a bunch of Native Americans saying that they should not have this mark, but it disparages people who were Native Americans. Here, you actually had people in the group trying to reclaim the term and drain its denigrating force. Simon Tam said he needed a registration to get a record deal. I don't know if that's true, but he said that there was a law that banned registration of words or names or symbols that are disparaging to people, institutions, et cetera. And he said this law discriminated based on viewpoint, or at least it didn't apply to him. This case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. He's the gentleman, one from the right. At the Supreme Court, the justices unanimously agreed that this law was inconsistent with the First Amendment. They noted that you could register words that celebrated Asians, like celebrations, but you could not register words that disparaged them. And so therefore, the law was invalid, and the Trademark Office could no longer invoke this provision of the Lanham Act, Section 2A, to refuse these registrations. At that point, all these people tried to register hate speech, swear words, all sorts of things. But then the PTO said, well, wait a second, we have these other rules, right? Maybe this is not distinctive, or maybe this phrase fails to function as a trademark. And so that's what they've been doing since then. But that didn't stop Eric Brunetti from trying to register F-U-C-T as a mark for clothing. He's a street artist. And claimed that F-U-C-T meant friends you can't trust, but everyone knows he was just trying to register the word fucked, right? And more recently, he's tried to register fuck, right, on its own. And that application was refused registration on failure to function grounds, and that's still pending. We're going to see what happens with that one. But for some reason, the trademark examiners kind of think this is different, right, because it's not exactly the spelling of the swear word. So he applies to register this phrase. It's refused registration on the ground. It's immoral or scandalous or both. After Tam, everyone was wondering, are there other laws that might be inconsistent with the right to freedom of expression? And the court followed a similar approach and said this law discriminates based on viewpoint. But some of the justices kind of went off, you know, kind of concurred and said, well, sure, we agree that this law is problematic. But, you know, we think Congress could actually ban the registration of highly profane terms, some vulgar terms, et cetera. And in the United States, obscene speech is not protected by the right to freedom of expression. So Congress could ban certain marks for those reasons. But at least the immoral and scandalous provisions were deemed to be inconsistent with the right to freedom of expression. So that's the Brunetti case. Next, we have the Vidal versus Elster case. So this photo is back from when Donald Trump was running for president the first time, right? It was debating Marco Rubio and others on stage. Trump was making fun of Marco Rubio, calling him Little Marco. And Marco Rubio said, well, at least I don't have small hands, because you know what they say about people with small hands. And here we have Trump holding up his hands. My hands aren't small, right? So after the debate, Stephen Elster, who's not a fan of Trump, applied to register Trump Too Small as a mark for t-shirts. Now, this was an intent to use application, but later he submitted photographs of the shirts that he planned to sell. And clearly he was using the phrase in a more of a decorative, ornamental, or expressive manner than as a trademark, although perhaps he also put it on the hang tags. And these, you know, these phrases are talking about the different ways that Trump is small, right? So he says that his application was refused kind of in a viewpoint discriminatory way. The provision here, though, that was cited was Section 2C, a law that bans registration of a person's name or image or signature without their consent. And here he did not have Trump's consent. The Trademark Office refused the application. Elster argues this is sort of like viewpoint discrimination. And the Supreme Court justices say, no, this is a viewpoint neutral law. It was not applied in a discriminatory way towards you. And this law is regulating speech based on its content, which typically in First Amendment law is a problem. But in trademark law, this is just the way it is, right? You have to make decisions based on the content of a mark to decide if it's likely to cause confusion with a previous mark, or if it is descriptive or generic, et cetera. So the court said, look, you know, if it's a viewpoint neutral, content-based law, but there's a history and tradition of this kind of law, and it furthers the goals of identifying sources of goods and services, like this is consistent with the First Amendment. So this is kind of a new thing, this historical tradition approach. Critics of this decision, which included me, focused on the fact that there actually wasn't a long history of this particular provision. There were laws banning registrations of people's names without their consent, right? There were laws banning registration of people's names if you couldn't show that they were distinctive, right? That they actually identified the person. And there were laws allowing people to use their own personal name as more as a defense. But this law was kind of recent. But still, after this case now, if you can show that this particular law has coexisted with the First Amendment for a while, you might be okay. Now, the United States is not the only country that has recognized that the right to freedom of expression can impose limits on trademark rights. In the European Union, we have actually in the preamble or recitals of the EU Trademark Directive and the EU Trademark Regulation, it says that courts need to take into account the right to freedom of expression. And in the Constantine film case, where someone had tried to register a phrase that was equivalent to like "fuck you, Goth" or something to that effect, this application had been refused registration on the ground it was contrary to morality and public policy. And so the court had occasion to consider whether there was a problem about this law for freedom of expression perspective. It just kind of briefly discussed the issue and said, we have to consider freedom of expression interests, but we're gonna just rule on doctrinal grounds, right? And it clarified what the rules are for proving that a mark is immoral or contrary to public policy. And in the end, I think most countries are not going to follow the United States in saying that you need to actually not ban immoral trademarks. They recognize that a registration doesn't prevent you from using the phrase, right? If anything, it's even more problematic from a free expression perspective, because then you get that exclusive right that you can use to stop other people from speaking. You can send them a cease and desist letter, and then they stop if they're a small business or an individual. You can file a complaint with an online marketplace. There was a woman who claimed trademark rights and cocky for romance novels about men that were arrogant or cocky. Then she got this registration and actually went to Amazon and got Amazon to take down books that had titles with the word cocky in them because of this registration. Ultimately, her registration was canceled. But we also had people who engaged in self-censorship, right? Once they saw she had a registration, they just said, oh, okay, I'll change my title. So very problematic, right, to get this registration of terms that provide information about products that are expressive or that are decorative. And I provide several examples in the book about this. So if you're trying to figure out, not just in the United States, but in any country, right, whether there is a potential conflict between a trademark law and the right to freedom of expression, you might want to consider certain issues. Now, I used to be a litigator, so I think of this as elements you have to prove. So this would be primarily the approach in the U.S., but this is going to apply, I think, in other countries too. So the first would be you have to show that this is government action, right, not private action in this trademark dispute. So if Facebook says you can't register someone else's trademark as a username, right, or takes down your post that's where you're selling counterfeit products, that's not a First Amendment violation. So we're focused here on when the government is the one either through laws banning your use of certain trademarks, or sorry, your registration or your use of certain trademarks, or courts are enforcing those trademark laws. Next, the trademark law has to ban, punish, chill, or otherwise harm expression. And so again, like, if you're banning registration, you can still use it. So the harm to freedom of expression is not as problematic compared to an injunction after a court finds trademark infringement or trademark dilution. Next, the trademark law has to regulate expression protected by the right to freedom of expression. It's not just regulating conduct or some sort of economic activity. So the trademark office might require you to pay a certain amount of money to register a trademark. that's not a content-based regulation of your speech, right? It's just a rule that you have to follow. Next, in the United States, the expression has to be private speech, not government speech. Why does this matter? Well, in the United States, government speech is basically when the government's speaking, and it can discriminate based on viewpoint. The U.S. government and certain military branches own trademarks, right? Be all you can be is an example for the Army. And they can decide, the government can decide, you know what, we're not going to try to register or use offensive trademarks, right? Hate speech, et cetera. So that's fine. In the TAM case, there was an argument here that because the government registered people's marks, that it then therefore became government speech. And the justices unanimously disagreed with that. Next, the expression has to not be categorically excluded from protection. Now, in the United States, there are certain types of speech that are just categorically deemed to be the kinds of language, you know, expression that the government can regulate. So I mentioned before, obscene speech is an example, fraudulent speech, misleading commercial speech. We don't have a problem when trademark laws are regulating these kinds of expression. And so in a typical trademark infringement case, if a court in the past kind of thought there might be a problem, they'd say, well, this isn't trademark infringement, it's misleading commercial speech. There's no First Amendment conflict. But again, in the United States, trademark laws apply to non-commercial speech. And they apply to non-misleading speech. These are trademark dilution laws that can apply to famous or well-known marks, right, regardless of whether there's any actual or likely confusion. So because of the fact that trademark laws are broader than just laws covering misleading commercial speech or fraudulent speech, we need to think next about whether the law fails the relevant free expression test for trademark. Now, in the United States, right, we have different tests that we might use depending on what kind of law it is or what the speech is. So if it's a law that discriminates based on viewpoint, right, like the Tam and Brunetti cases, typically you would have to satisfy strict or heightened level scrutiny. Now, in those cases, basically everyone agreed that the laws were inconsistent with the First Amendment. The court didn't actually consider whether this law was narrowly tailored to further a compelling government interest. But I think if the court did apply this strict scrutiny analysis, it would find the law to be inconsistent with the free speech right. We know after Elster, if there's a historical tradition of this kind of trademark law, it's going to be okay, right? Typically, right? But if there is no historical tradition and the law is viewpoint neutral, but it's content-based, then we need to figure out, where do we go from here? The United States Supreme Court did not provide a framework here for figuring out what analysis you should use. And also, it's not clear in other countries how you should evaluate whether a trademark law is consistent with the right to freedom of expression. If it's non-commercial speech, typically under the First Amendment jurisprudence of the Supreme Court, you would apply strict scrutiny analysis, the highest kind of analysis. But if it is commercial speech, you might only have to satisfy intermediate scrutiny analysis under a test in a case called Central Hudson. Some people say, look, you know, these laws, as long as they're reasonable, they should be okay, right? In copyright law, for example, the Supreme Court has said that even though copyright laws regulate the content of speech, as long as Congress does not alter the traditional contours of the law, we do already have doctrines like the idea expression dichotomy, the fair use defense, that adequately protects speech interests. I've argued, others have argued, trademark law doesn't have adequate speech protective provisions in it right now. And so that's why we shouldn't just use that analysis. For those of you who are not familiar with U.S. constitutional law, here's the strict scrutiny analysis test and the intermediate scrutiny analysis. The key difference is, right, is for strict scrutiny, it has to be a compelling government interest, and you have to show it's the least restrictive alternative. And so some people say this is almost always fatal, but sometimes laws do actually satisfy this analysis. For intermediate scrutiny analysis, there have been laws that have been struck down. So it's not toothless, but it's obviously easier to satisfy this rule because you only have to show there's a substantial government interest. The law directly materially furthers that interest and is not narrowly drawn, not more extensive than necessary to serve that interest. Now, this particular approach is kind of similar to balancing tests that you see in Europe and other countries. And in the book, I don't say that everyone should use this approach. I'm just letting you know this is what we do in the US. And what about this reasonableness argument? Well, in the Elster case, when just talking about trademark registration laws, again, which allow you to use the term still, right, just prevents you from registering it, we have Justices Barrett and Sotomayor, again, a conservative and liberal justice, so they're both on the same side here, all the women basically joining together, joined by Justices Kagan and Jackson, and they say, look, you know, if this law is reasonable in light of trademark law's purpose of facilitating source identification, it's fine. We don't have to subject it to intermediate or strict scrutiny analysis. But just be clear, this is not the test of the Supreme Court majority, and this test would not apply to trademark enforcement laws, which actually do suppress speech. Now, one critique I have of their argument here is that the law at issue in Elster was not furthering trademark law's source identifying function. It was protecting the rights of privacy and publicity, right, by preventing someone from registering another person's name or image or portrait. I'm sorry, name or image or signature. And so what I wish the justices had done was actually struggle with the question of whether protecting a person's right of publicity or right of privacy is a substantial or compelling government interest. This is a really important issue right now with deepfakes, right, digital replicas, and a lot of them are misleading. And it would have been nice to have some clarity from the Supreme Court on this topic, but I think maybe they didn't want to talk about this because you have INTA, International Trademark Association, AIPLA, all saying, okay, whatever you do, this might impact this other area of the law. So instead they go this historical tradition route and focus on the source identifying function. My proposal, right? So I suggest that when countries, either judges or legislatures are trying to decide how to balance trademark and free expression rights, they should consider three things. And this is similar to the constitutional analysis I've talked about before, but it's a little bit different. So first, you want to ask, what's the purpose of this specific trademark law? Not just trademark laws generally. Sure, trademark laws can prevent misleading uses of trademarks. That's what infringement laws do, laws banning, you know, deceptive trademarks. Trademark laws can promote fair competition. So these are two arguments I make, is that preventing misleading uses of marks, promoting fair competition, those are typically goals of trademark law. I think everyone would agree with, it's good things to, you know, to further, but also helping people identify the source of goods and services. You see this language in the EU, in the United States, many different decisions, right? But the problem is not every trademark law furthers those goals. Again, Section 2C, the names provision, protects the right of publicity, right of privacy. So you need to figure out what the purpose is, and then you ask, does this law further that purpose? Do the ends justify the means? But then you don't just stop there. You also ask whether this law suppresses or chills speech that's protected by the right to freedom of expression. If it's suppressing fraudulent speech, misleading speech, well, not a problem, right? At least in the United States, but I think other countries too. If it does suppress or chill speech, right, then you ask, well, is it no more than necessary to further the goals that were identified in one? So in the book, I apply this framework in various contexts. And I say that, you know, countries could use this approach and kind of tweak it to work for their particular jurisdiction. My main argument is, look, most trademark registration and enforcement laws are furthering important trademark goals, right? They do adequately protect speech interests, but not all. And so legislatures, courts have to think about this issue, and trademark offices, actually. I've argued this in previous scholarship. Others have too. But again, in the book, I argue that dilution law is inconsistent with the right to freedom of expression because these laws regulate non-misleading speech. They do apply primarily to commercial expression. So it's a lower level of scrutiny you might apply. However, they do discriminate based on viewpoint. So you would need that higher level of scrutiny, right? Strict scrutiny in the United States is what I argue. But even if you just apply intermediate scrutiny, it's not going to be consistent with the right to freedom of expression in the U.S., I argue. And this case is actually, this particular issue is going may be dealt with, and I'll talk about that in a second. Dilution laws apply to dissimilar goods and services. So if you have a famous mark or a well-known mark, you could have rights across industries. And this right can apply when the use is not misleading, when the parties are not competitors, and there's no evidence of unfair competition or actual harm to the mark. So that's a problem. The other argument in the book, and this takes up probably more of the book, is my argument that if we're talking about subject matter, words, names, designs, that has substantial inherent value, that we shouldn't register these marks, or we should only give them a narrow scope of protection. And I kind of break it down into the three categories I mentioned before, right? Informational matter, expressive matter, and decorative matter. And I have some examples for you in a later slide. And again, this is pre-existing value. So this is different than a situation where you might have a mark like Barbie for dolls, and then people start to use this mark in songs about the Barbie girl, for example, right? This is where there was value before someone tried to register it, not value that's added after someone registers it. I also talk about the fact that we need more defensive doctrines and trademark statutes. Graham Dinwiddie has written a defensive doctrines paper that's really great that talks about this. I agree with him that it's helpful to have these kinds of doctrines in the statute, not just in judicial opinions, because then it provides more certainty to parties. But even the ones that we have right now that are currently in statutes are kind of unclear. And I'll talk about some of the limitations of these statutory defenses. But I talk about all of the provisions in U.S. law, in the EU trademark directive and regulation, some examples from New Zealand, Australia, Singapore in the book. So it just my goal is to say, look, these are what countries are doing. Think about this, countries, right? So maybe you can protect speech interests better if you adopt these kinds of rules. And then lastly, I talk about safe harbor defenses for online service providers. And I encourage companies like Amazon or eBay or Google, right, social media companies, to not automatically take down expression or products when someone accuses a user of trademark violations. Obviously, it's very difficult. It's expensive for them to make a case-by-case determination. But perhaps you have a notice and takedown regime where they take it down, but then you allow a counter notification and then it goes back up unless the complaining party files a trademark lawsuit. These are kind of the things that I focus on in the book. Here are some examples of what I'm talking about here. So I mentioned before that one of the goals of trademark law, right, is to prevent or kind of discourage, right, fraudulent, misleading uses of trademarks. Any laws that target these kinds of marks are probably constitutional. So if your law bans deceptive trademarks or uses likely to cause confusion with another mark, it's probably going to be okay in the United States, but also in other countries. Provisions that promote fair competition are also consistent with the right to freedom of expression, right? We have laws that ban the registration of descriptive marks that are not that have not acquired distinctiveness. Of functional matter, right? Either that's technically functional, like something that could be covered by a patent, but also things that might be decorative and desired by consumers for aesthetic reasons that have nothing to do with the reputation of the trademark owner. Primarily geographically descriptive matter, surnames, right? Someone's last name. Those are all things that either can't be registered at all or that you can only register with proof of secondary meaning or acquired distinctiveness. I've already talked about Section 2C. There's a law that has a historical tradition that might also be okay after Elster. But there are other laws in the United States that regulate expression for other reasons. The North American Free Trade Agreement between Mexico, United States, and Canada, and the trade-related aspects of intellectual property agreement, right, it's a WTO agreement, they require nations to not register mislabeled geographical indications. It doesn't necessarily have to be confusing, but this is just an international obligation. Section 2B, so that's 2A, Section 2B of the Lanham Act says that the PTO won't register flags and other kinds of government symbols. The Paris Convention, which is incorporated into TRIPS, has a provision saying that you should not register as a nation, right, these kinds of marks. This is common in all countries throughout the world that are members of the Paris Union. So here we go. Here are laws that comply with international obligations. This is not going to be alone be good enough. In the United States, if something's unconstitutional for First Amendment reasons, the court might still strike it down, but at least this is a reason why we have these laws. There might be other reasons too. Trademark dilution law? I don't know, right? We have laws that ban registration of marks that might dilute a famous trademark in the US, and also trademark enforcement laws that ban uses of marks that might cause dilution by blurring or tarnishment. And the problem with these laws is that they protect the goodwill or reputation of a trademark owner where the use is not misleading. And again, there's no evidence of unfair competition. There's no evidence of actual harm that's required by the statute. So that's the law banning registration. Not as problematic, right? Because you could still use it. Although then we have a law that says you can't still use it, right? Section 43C of the Lanham Act basically says that a owner of a famous mark can prevent uses of their mark that cause blurring by blurring or tarnishment, again, regardless of the presence or absence of confusion, competition, or actual economic injury. So this is a problematic law. And right now, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, this is the court that's the West Coast of the United States, is considering appeal of the Jack Daniel's case. I'd mentioned this before. I don't know if you've heard of it, right? VIP Products sells parody dog toys. And one of its dog toys was making fun of Jack Daniel's whiskey. You know, it's the old number 7 is their branding, right? You have the black and white decorations. Well, VIP Products has basically a dog on the front with a bunch of poop jokes, right? The old number 2 on your Tennessee carpet, et cetera. I think no one was probably confused that Jack Daniel's was selling this product, but some people were confused. I think there was a survey that showed 30% people thought they had to get permission to do this. So this case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. The VIP Products company has said that this is an artistic design. We should be able to benefit from this Rogers balancing test, right? Where you have to show this use is explicitly misleading. So it's a higher threshold for infringement liability. But the Supreme Court says, you know what? You're claiming trademark rights in this design. And their complaint, where they tried to claim that they were not liable, a deck relief action, they said they own trademark rights in the trade dress and the phrase bad spaniels. And the Supreme Court said, if you yourself are claiming trademark rights, right, just like Taylor Swift, just like, you know, the Dogue Woman, you can't take advantage of the Rogers test or another First Amendment threshold that prevents you from going to the traditional likelihood of confusion factors. So it's not that the plaintiff wins, but you have to kind of go through this 8-factor test. If you're a big company like VIP, maybe it's not a problem. But if you're a small business or an individual, that can be expensive. What's nice about the Rogers test and some of these other doctrines is you can get rid of the case early on a motion to dismiss before discovery. Discovery is very expensive in the United States, right? You're getting documents, you know, asking questions, et cetera. And so for, you know, pretty much only big companies can afford to go and have these cases resolved on summary judgment or later at trial. But what was great about this opinion is that it had some speech protective language. It said that if you're making fun of a trademark owner, no one's going to be confused that the trademark owner is the one that's doing the mocking. And the court said that you could actually have a ruling on likelihood of confusion at the motion to dismiss stage early on, which was great. So the case gets sent back down to Arizona. Oh, and then one other thing, under the trademark dilution law, they said that they couldn't take advantage of the parody defense because it had to be a non-trademark use. And there's this non-commercial use exclusion, which typically might apply to, you know, films, songs, political speech, et cetera. But they said, look, this is decorative, right? This is not used as a trademark in a commercial sense. In the front, you know, our marks VIP products are silly squeakers. But the court said, well, you're claiming trademark rights in this, so you can't take advantage of the non-commercial use of a mark exception, which is kind of very wrong. Sorry, Louise. This is very wrong, right? So the Supreme Court justices, many of whom now focus on the text of the statute, completely ignored the text. The text did not require a non-trademark use for the non-commercial use of a mark defense. But the court said, well, this earlier provision said it had to be non-trademark use if it was parody. And so therefore, we're going to read this limitation on the defense into the statute. So the case goes back down to the Arizona District Court, who does find this to be a successful parody, no likelihood of confusion. But the district court says, well, we don't like the fact that you're associating poop with something that people drink, and so we think it dilutes by tarnishment. Well, tarnishment law often applies if this use is offensive, right? If it's sex, drugs, I would say rock and roll, but usually that's not offensive. Sex and drugs and other kinds of offensive things like dog poop. And so we'll see what happens. The case is now on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. Rebecca Tushnet has written an excellent amicus brief that I joined and commented on, where we're arguing that dilution by tarnishment law is inconsistent with the right to freedom of expression. Jake Linford, a professor in Florida, has argued that this law is consistent. Is consistent with the free speech right. He doesn't think the court's going to strike down any other laws. We'll see what happens. It'll be interesting to see if other countries start to consider whether certain laws might be consistent with the right to freedom of expression or not. So that's the trademark enforcement context. Let's go back to the trademark registration context. So in the book, in my first chapter, which is available online for free, if you don't want to buy it, it's on SSRN. But I talk about three examples of what I call inherently valuable expressions. Superheroes, which is claimed as a mark for comic books, various other goods and services. Lifeguard, which is claimed as a mark for t-shirts. And then a Crystal Head Vodka skull design. It's basically a shape of their packaging for vodka. And they have been pretty litigious with regard to enforcing it in contexts that have nothing to do with vodka. So here's an example that I'm going to talk about today. So you may have heard of DC and Marvel, right? They are the biggest comic book, sellers. They provide movies, right? Television shows about superheroes. They jointly owned a registration for superheroes, for comic books, for toys, for clothing like t-shirts. And they owned Superhero for masquerade costumes, things you might wear like at Halloween. And the examples that they provided of how they're using the mark, I would argue, are not trademark uses, right? Here, the words Marvel or DC tell you who's providing this particular product. Superhero is providing information about the story. So here's one of their examples. Here's another example of what's called a specimen of use, evidence of their use, which, again, I would argue it's just talking about what the publication is about. So they owned a registration for publications. Typically, they've mostly been trying to prevent other people from registering superheroes or superhero as a mark for various products like beer, other kinds of publications, et cetera. But they have enforced it in some context. Dan Taylor is a comic book author, and they came out with this Superhero Happy Hour. Basically, it was a comic about superheroes getting together at a bar after a tough day of fighting crime, right? And Marvel, at some point, DC contacted him and said, you can't use superhero in the title of your comic book. And so it was changed to Hero Happy Hour, which I think is not as effective. And it talks about this fact that that's why they changed it. This is the main example of where they've actually enforced it. There are a couple of examples I talk about in the book. But I did a deep dive into all the evidence they claim shows their use of this phrase, superheroes, as a trademark. Again, I would argue this is either an informational, expressive, or decorative use of this phrase. And that my argument is that no one should own exclusive rights to superheroes in this context, right, for these kinds of goods and services. So this is not just a general rule that no one should register superheroes for anything, but you have to think about the goods and services at issue and whether it would harm freedom of expression or be anti-competitive to register it. Someone actually challenged their application, their registrations for superheroes. And interestingly, they just let them lapse, except for this one. Superheroes for entertainment services. This is like Lego minifigure, like TV shows and stuff. They still have an active registration here. But again, I would argue it's DC and Marvel that tell you who's providing the product here. It's not going to be superheroes is not serving a source identifying function. But again, this is a screenshot of the PTO website where it shows that they still jointly own rights in this context. So to step back, my book introduces this concept of inherently valuable expression in trademark law. And again, this is matter with pre-existing informational, expressive, or decorative value in an industry or community before it was claimed as a trademark. So some examples of subject matter with substantial inherent value, right? I've already talked about generic and descriptive words, other informational terms and symbols, right? UFO is registered as a mark for publications that talk about UFOs. Popular colors and color combinations. People claim trademark rights in the color black or red or, an example of substantial inherent value, right? The three colors of the U.S. flag or other flags, right? Red, white, and blue. Creative works and words or names associated with them. The Uncle Sam image, a German company tried to register this for various party supplies and beer. A French company tried to register this illustration of the Mona Lisa for sausages. Martin Simfleben, Amsterdam University, has written a great book, The Trademark Copyright Divide, where kind of argues that perhaps we should not register trademark in cultural heritage works. And it's a great book. I highly recommend it. And so I kind of follow on with some of his arguments and say it's not just the images, too, but also, and he says this, too, the words associated, the Mona Lisa is registered as a mark for various kinds of goods as well. Names are likenesses of historical figures, leaders, and celebrities. Jesus is registered as a mark for genes, and there are many universities in the United States that have the names of our founding fathers. I'm not saying that these should not necessarily be registered, but if we do register them, we should have narrow rights. Words and designs of value to indigenous communities like Cherokee, Kokopelli is an example. Political messages and slogans for social movements like Black Lives Matter, Make America Great Again. Trending phrases, memes, and lyrics, right? Okay, Boomer is an example of something that was a meme a couple of years ago, not so much these days. Puns and jokes, let us turn up the beat, right? Was registered as a mark for t-shirts. Positive and uplifting sentiment. Someone tried to register, I love you, for jewelry. That looked like this, right? That the words, that was, it was actually refused registration on ornamentality grounds. Holidays, people try to register the names of holidays, you know, bride-to-be, those kinds of things. Communicative symbols. Gene Simmons of the rock band Kiss tried to register the devil's horns hand gesture. I talk about that a lot in the book. Common words and symbols displayed on t-shirts and other expressive merchandise. In addition to the ones I already talked about, right? Everybody versus racism. Somebody tried to register that. I Heart New York, that is registered. I Heart DC was refused registration on failure to function grounds. Lifeguard is one I talk about in the book. And then the crystal had vodka, a skull design. They actually told a British couple from the UK that they couldn't sell hot sauce in this shape. Now they do own a registration, a copyright registration and a design patent for the shape. Okay, fine, but those will eventually expire. Trademark rights can last forever. And so, you know, regardless of what you think of overlapping rights, I think that they should not, if they're gonna have rights, I don't have a problem with Clovefill having exclusive rights to the shape for vodka, but for other products, they should have narrow rights. So I'm getting to the end of my time here. So the book kind of talks about the different types of doctrines that can be invoked in the United States and other countries to refuse registrations of expression with substantial inherent value. So I can answer any questions you might have about this later. So I say, look, either we don't register these kinds of marks, or we just have a narrow scope of protection. You get rights for your particular mark for your goods or service, right? You can't get rights across industries or even related industries if it's a mark with substantial value. Perhaps we require the defendant to actually use the mark as a trademark for liability. This is not required in most jurisdictions in the United States and in many countries. Or maybe we say, look, you have to show this is a false statement about your own goods and services or is likely to mislead about the source of your products or your message. Just the fact that some people might be confused about permission, that's not gonna be good enough. There are some speech protective and pro-competitive trademark enforcement laws that I talk about in the book, the likelihood of confusion test, which does only applies to infringement claims, commercial use and trademark use are required in some jurisdictions. Trademark use is required in Australia and New Zealand, but not in many other places. I talk about descriptive fair use, nominative fair uses. I've already mentioned the Rogers test. If it's a successful parody, you might be okay. Aesthetic functionality is a defense in some jurisdictions in the U.S. And you could argue in the EU and other places that this particular use is not distinctive or is merely informational, expressive, or decorative. So I don't have time to go into these in detail. So just again, the book does, and I can talk about this in the Q&A. And then just to kind of end, my friend, Christine Farley, she's a professor at American University. She and I proposed kind of a replacement to the Rogers test. And to be honest, replacement to all these different kinds of defensive doctrines and saying, look, if it's an informational expressive use, maybe we should just focus on whether this is a false statement about licensing or sponsorship or affiliation, or if this use is likely to mislead about source. If it's not, then we should allow this to protect the right to freedom of expression. So that is my presentation, and I will open it up to questions if anyone has any.